Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Now we're talking about banks, the rates, the fakes, the too big to fail.
I want to make very clear that we never directed nor wanted our team members to provide products and services to customers that they did not want. It is against everything we stand for as a company. That said, I accept full responsibility for all unethical sales practices in our retail banking business.
That's Wells Fargo Bank CEO John Stumpf testifying on Capitol Hill yesterday. He was trying to explain why bank employees created nearly 2 million false accounts to plump up their sales numbers. The bank has fired more than 5,000 employees. It's paying large fines. But this is not the first time Wells Fargo has been caught breaking the rules. More on that, what other banks do, in the congressional hearing in a moment. We'll also get to, at some point in the conversation, the Federal Reserve interest rates and why we still have banks that are too big to fail. As our guests join us this morning, I think it'd be valuable to hear whether your bank, Wells Fargo or not, has earned your trust, whether you believe it's time to refocus on the size and the activities of American banks again. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. On Twitter, where I'm hearing from some of you on this, and I'll get to some of those Twitter comments here in a moment, you can reach me at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. We requested an interview with an executive at Wells Fargo. They declined to participate in the conversation. Our guest today, Elizabeth Dexheimer, is a reporter for Bloomberg. She attended the Wells Fargo hearing yesterday. She's with us from Washington. I cannot wait, Elizabeth, to hear what it was like to be in the room. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Kerri, thanks for having me on.
Lisa Gerstner is with us. She's a contributing editor at Kiplinger Personal Finance, and she's with us from New Mexico. And Lisa, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And later in the hour, Ben Protas is going to be with us. He's a reporter for the New York Times Dealberg book column. So, Elizabeth, I've watched some of Elizabeth Warren's interaction with the Wells Fargo CEO. How would you say he did in defending or apologizing for some of these practices?
Well, Elizabeth Warren was definitely the most colorful exchange. But I would add that it really sort of the heat he got came from both sides of the aisle. Generally, he checked the boxes in terms of apologizing, expressing regret. But the general consensus is that he really fell short in, he knew he was going to be asked a lot of tough questions, a lot of just basic questions about what he knew and what other executives knew and when. And what steps the company has taken to reprimand some more senior managers. And generally, the takeaway from a number of lawmakers was that he didn't really answer those questions, other questions about executive pay and what the board would do. So generally, the takeaway was that, yes, sort of checked off the boxes. We really didn't learn a whole lot more about the investigation or about the incident after his testimony, quite frankly.
Elizabeth, did you get any clarity? Is he walking a very fine line when he says no one directed employees to do this? Because what I can't understand is why there seems to be no one in the bank who is saying this was the practice. It's not a practice that only happens at Wells Fargo. Trying to get to the bottom of that. Did you get any clarity on that?
Not really, unfortunately. I mean, he's definitely walking a fine line on a number of these topics. And, several sources that I've talked to on Capitol Hill do raise the point that whether or not it's about what the board is considering about, taking action to claw back pay, or whether or not it's specifically when he and other top managers learned about this activity and what the bank was doing to investigate and reprimand lower level employees. It's a question of whether of what he knows versus what he can and and can't say versus what regulators, you know, where, you know, he may not be able to speak in terms of the settlements that he's reached with regulators, but definitely walking a fine line on a number of points. And unfortunately, there's just not a lot of clarity around around a lot of basic questions still.
Lisa, I've been reading that that this cross-selling within large banks is pretty common. Wells Fargo isn't the only bank that does this. Is that true?
That is true. There are, I would say, probably all of the major large banks do this cross-selling. It's a focus for all of these banks, high-pressure sales, trying to get people to sign up for all different kinds of accounts. So yeah, it's pretty common.
And the reason that they do this to open new accounts is because they're hoping to collect fees from the accounts. Is that how it works?
Yeah, well, in general, the more accounts that they can open with a customer, the more money they can potentially make off of that. You know, connecting your savings account to your checking account to move money between them and, yeah, possibly collecting more fees that way.
Okay, but, yeah, just to be clear here, Lisa, the benefit to the bank is that if they connect your savings account with your checking account, there might be a fee at some point in that for the bank. I mean, why do this the way they do?
It is possible. For example, if you set up your savings account to send money to your checking if you overdraft, many banks do charge a fee for that. So even though they automatically pull that money, they may charge you $10 or $14 to do that. Now, Chase Bank, one of the big banks, actually did eliminate their fee for that. So it's possible more banks will stop doing that, but that's one way they may get a fee. Also, monthly maintenance fees. You know, free checking is getting harder and harder to find. So. You have to keep, you know, direct deposits or a minimum balance in order to not get a $10 fee on your account. The fees have really been creeping on.
Yeah, we have a call here from somebody who I think got caught up in some of those fees to Ralph in St. Paul. Hey, Ralph, how did this work for you?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a small business owner, and I was invited to open a checking account. I got wooed by Wells Fargo. And so I said, okay, we'll try it. I opened a free business checking account, and I had the account for, I think, 3 weeks. And I just put $100 in it to get it started. And I was working on other things, and I got a note from the bank that I was overdrawn. And I went to them and go, what the heck is this? They had opened some service, and the service basically cost money, and so they charged me for it, and then all of a sudden I'm overdrawn, and I hadn't even done anything. I hadn't even gotten the checks for the account at that point, and, you know, I went to them and said, okay, you know, you guys stole my money. I want it back. I never did get it back, and this was 5 or 6 years ago, so when I heard this on the radio yesterday, I'm like, you know what, this is not surprising in the slightest. They've been up to this for years.
Yeah, you know, Ralph, I appreciate the call. Elizabeth, did you get a sense from some of the discussion among the members of Congress that, again, Wells Fargo is not the only bank trying to meet these quotas and doing this kind of stuff?
Well, definitely the point was raised, and regulators, the OCC and CFPB, have raised the point as well. The OCC has said that they will be looking into these sort of practices at other banks. Other members of Congress as well have started to say that, you know, this is a point that they're making. I do believe that it was the CFPB, though, that has said that in their sort of study of this already, that Wells Fargo does stand out as being particularly aggressive in cross-sell, and they've certainly always tried to distinguish themselves as being, you know, particularly successful in this. I would also say that the bank is doing, to Ralph's concerns there, that they're widening the scope of their own investigation in terms of how far back this activity occurred, and they are saying that they are, you know, going to be reaching out to all customers to, you know, communicate, rather, you know, fixing the problem if it has occurred, or just, you know, reassuring customers that they weren't affected by this.
I hear that, Elizabeth, but then I look back at Wells Fargo's record over, I don't know, like the last 2 years, $10 billion in fines over a mortgage investigation, $203 million on some of the shenanigans that they've been pulling on debit card payments. You know, this may be just the latest thing that is exposed, but their record is not good when you look into the background.
No, and that's even small compared to the record of other big banks as well and the fines that they've paid. For sure. And actually, what's interesting about this is that the actual consumer harm, as well as the fine, even though it was a record fine, is was not material, was actually not nearly as big as some of the other fines that we've seen around mortgages and otherwise. So again, sort of the scope of this is as this does continue to unfold, or as people look into it, it's a lot about, you know, sort of the reputational harm that the bank is taking for this and that issue of trust that you've raised.
Well, I hear you on the size of the fines, but I mean, they're paying fines, Wells Fargo and the other banks, because they've done something that they, while not publicly admitting is wrong, they have to acknowledge is wrong, or they wouldn't pay the fines.
Right.
I mean, their action, yes, I get it with the reputation, but what's being done about what's actually happening inside the banks?
It's a good question. You look at the stock and sort of investor reaction to this, and certainly calmed down yesterday around the hearing, but certainly last week, you know, plummeted quite a bit. And what investors have been reacting to is not those numbers. It mm-hmm. is the wider reputational harm and, you know, the risk that this is an ongoing investigation. We're, you know, perhaps more congressional activity as well as, you know, a DOJ investigation or other criminal investigations like what Elizabeth Warren has called for. That's sort of where the risk is.
Kristen says on Twitter, when I was younger, friends at local banks would try to get people to open accounts to meet quotas as well. This is not just Wells Fargo. She says none of us wanted these additional accounts. We already had one, but we felt like we needed to help. To the phones to John in Mankato. Hi, John. Hey, John, are you there? We might have lost him. I think he was calling to say that he works for Wells Fargo. He says everything in the media is 95% true. If you don't put up a lot of numbers, you get put on performance improvement plans. A lot of employees are glad this is being exposed. It's fishy and bad. You risk your job if you talk too. Lisa, is that something you're aware of?
Yeah, I actually listened into a conference call yesterday with some former bankers with Wells Fargo, as well as with some other banks, and yeah, everything you're hearing seems to be pretty true. You know, one of them was a teller at Wells Fargo, and he said there was a daily quota of trying to get 10 to 15 personal account signs up just in a day.
Wow.
Yeah, and it wasn't only that, oh, you get financial incentive if you meet these goals. It's that you may lose your job if you don't. So they were kind of burning, you know, both ends there with people, and you were trying to avoid disciplinary action with these. You know, there was a former branch manager from Wells Fargo who claimed that it was kind of a culture of harassment and fear where she was. And, you know, they were trying to sell, well, you've probably heard the Great Eight combination of various products and services, whether it's mortgages, checking accounts, savings accounts, credit cards. So at least according to what these people said, it's pretty common.
And Lisa, when you say, you know, they're meeting quotas and they're, quote unquote, trying to sell, are they contacting customers and saying, please add this service to your portfolio within the bank? Because that's not what was happening. These accounts were just being opened with fake PIN numbers and not getting in contact with customers, as far as I could tell. What's your sense?
Right. You know, in theory, they should be at least contacting people and asking them if they want to join these accounts. But I think the pressure that was put on them to open so many is what caused these fraudulent actions, just signing people up for things without asking their permission. You know, they went, you know, some of them even said they were told, even by management, yes, you can go ahead and sign people up for debit cards. You can sign them up for online banking, and you don't have to ask. These are things that they should be asking people before they simply put them in it.
Lisa Gerstner is one of our guests this morning. She's a contributing editor at Kiplinger Personal Finance. And Elizabeth Dexheimer is with us. She's a reporter for Bloomberg. And she was at this hearing on Capitol Hill yesterday where the CEO of Wells Fargo testified. Did not go particularly well. We'll play a little bit of the interaction between Senator Elizabeth Warren and a member of Congress, but reminding you this morning that this is a conversation about what we've learned about what happened inside Wells Fargo. The bank has fired more than 5,000 employees, is going to pay and is paying large fines, As I noted in the introduction, not the first time Wells Fargo or other banks have been caught breaking the rules. And we're talking about trust in banks, what you should know as a customer, how you make a decision. I think this is an important part of the conversation, how you make a decision about banks to do business with and how you can trust them. 651-227-6000. Do you think it's time to refocus on the size and the rules and the activities of American banks again? There are some in Congress who believe that. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR to Bill in Minneapolis. Hi, Bill.
Hi there. I am an attorney, and I'm a resident of Southeast Minneapolis. I've had an account, both personal and business, with Wells Fargo at their University Midway branch for 25 years. I have never had a problem. In fact, the bank has been very helpful to me as different banking problems have periodically come up related to my business accounts.
Mm-hmm.
I have a trust account. I guess my point is that I do have multiple accounts, but I'm the one that's, you know, talked to bankers as different situations have arisen over the years, and I'm the one that basically initiated the type of business account that I have, the trust account, my personal savings, personal checking.
So you willingly added some services to your account, and all has gone well with Wells Fargo
right.
for you.
So okay. I'm curious as to how many of these 5,300 employees that were terminated, how many of them have been in Minnesota versus other states?
Okay.
I just
Let's ask Elizabeth that here for a second. Do you know the answer to that, Elizabeth?
So it's my understanding that most of the scope of what the bank found of where the 2 million accounts or so, most of that occurred in Southwest and in Western U.S., which is consistent with where the bank is based in San Francisco and has grown considerably in size since the financial crisis. But if you look at the years, the West Coast and Southwest. However, they haven't been very specific of breaking that down further, so there's still more that we could learn.
Yeah, Elizabeth, I wanted to play, and Lisa, a bit of the interaction between Senator Elizabeth Warren and the CEO of Wells Fargo, John Stump, where she gets to this point about, yes, employees have been fired, yes, you've fired some of your lower-level executives, but why hasn't anybody up the chain been fired because of this? So let's listen.
Okay, so you haven't resigned, you haven't returned a single nickel of your personal earnings, you haven't fired a single senior executive. Instead, evidently your definition of accountable is to push the blame to your low-level employees who don't have the money for a fancy PR firm to defend themselves. It's gutless leadership.
I have to imagine, Elizabeth, that John Stumpf knew he was in for a tough road. What was his answer to that?
He did not, if I recall, he didn't have a whole lot to say in response. Right. He knew that sort of that line of questioning was coming in some sense. It really is up to the board. He kept, kind of referring to that it's in the board's hand and the compensation committee on the board to decide, whether or not to claw back pay or what. Sort of the fate of his job and some of the other senior executives. And that is true to some sense, and that, it really is in the board's hands to decide what's next with this. But certainly there's quite a bit of pressure from Elizabeth Warren and others.
And to the phones to Dave in New Richmond. Hi, Dave.
Hello. I've been curious with the banks having to pay all these large millions and millions of dollars of fines. Who receives that money? Does it go back to the people that have been cheated, the customers?
Lisa, do you know where the money goes when it's fined? I don't think it goes back to the customers unless the bank commits to that, does it?
Yeah, I believe it's separate which money goes back to customers. I want to say Wells Fargo is returning about $2.5 million, and some of it they may have already returned to customers since this has been going on for years. As for the other fines, I don't know exactly how they portion that out. I know that there were various entities that fined Wells Fargo. The CFPB was one. I think Los Angeles County was one. So Those would go in kind of those different directions.
Elizabeth, I know you have to run. Before you go, is this pretty much the end of this? We have one hearing that gets some attention and moving on, or what happens from Washington's standpoint?
Oh, it continues. The House is going to be holding their own hearing and doing their own investigation. The day yet has not been scheduled, but Jeb Hensarling, who's chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, says that he wants to hold a hearing with Stumpf by the end of this month, and Congress is not in session for much longer. So this will definitely continue, and you've already seen a number of lawmakers seize on this to sort of expand on their own political agenda, if you will, or certain issues that are important to them. And certainly with the CFPB, for example, Democrats have been, have used this as an example of why the CFPB, is working and why legislation that Republicans have pushed to, make changes to Dodd-Frank shouldn't happen. Issues around whether or not the SEC should investigate, whether Wells Fargo should have disclosed information that was material around this beforehand. That's another sort of line of questioning and otherwise that lawmakers are talking about now. So this definitely continues to make quite a bit of noise on Capitol Hill.
Your remarks about that consumer protection board are well taken. Wasn't Elizabeth Warren supposed to run that for a while until that became controversial?
That's right. She is a big supporter and advocate for the CFPB and has definitely, used this Wells Fargo incident as an example of why she thinks, the CFPB is necessary and, why there should be, tougher rules and, the CFPB should be given even, more direction to, go after this sort of activity.
I appreciate you being with us, Elizabeth. Thanks much.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Dexheimer for Bloomberg, and she was at the Wells Fargo hearing on Capitol Hill. Lisa Gerstner continues with us. She contributes as an editor to Kiplinger Personal Finance. On Twitter here, Mary says, until bankers face real jail time for their misdeeds, monetary penalties will mean nothing, and the egregious behavior won't stop. To the phones to Alan in Minnetonka. Hi, Alan.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Yep, I'm a Wells Fargo customer, and actually they did open an account for me, but it wasn't a big deal. It was like a save-as-you-go out of my checking account. And, that was not a big deal. It was kind of like a pressure thing at the end of the day type thing. But anyway, my question had two things. One is I bet my hunch is that they targeted people with low credit scores. The guy Bill that called in, the lawyer, clearly they're not going to, try to open an account on him. He's a sharp guy. He's probably, got it all together. He's got plenty of time to, observe and monitor. And then you can go over low credit people. They have multiple jobs, lower income, lower education, and they're probably easy targets for this kind of activity, which is just basically criminal activity. Why do you call it that? It's unbelievable that you're I'm going to get a little bit heated up. But, okay. And then the other thing is, what is it going to take? What is it going to take for America to look at, why they don't want to pull the curtain back? Because it's all fraudulent from the monetary system up.
Okay. So, Alan, that's not what the show is about, but we'll address your first question here, which is, Lisa, do we have some sense about how the banks and which customers the banks target for these extra services?
Yeah, I don't know that there was any, profiling or anything like that. It's quite possible there was, and, that is a point to consider. I will say to his point that if you are a customer, it is a good idea to check your credit reports.
Exactly.
He mentioned, they're probably not paying attention, they're busy. Going to annualcreditreport.com and just looking at your three credit bureau reports is a good idea right now to see if there's anything new on there, any credit cards, any bank accounts that you don't have, because it could be a product of that.
Did you say anyoldcreditreport.com? I've never heard
sorry.
Of that.
I'll clarify a little more. It's called
annualcreditreport.com.
Okay.
All right, good.
And that is the site to go to get your credit report.
And actually, sometimes, like, I have a couple of credit cards that actually offer me that service twice a year, you know, to access my credit report or something like that. So you may already have that.
There are a lot of other ways now. CreditKarma.com is also a good site. They don't necessarily give you the full-on credit report, but they give you pretty much all the information from two of your credit reports, and you can do that all year long. So there are more ways.
And do you have a sense, Lisa, about is there anywhere in the fine print that those of us with lives don't have time to read that gives the bank permission? I mean, are we actually signing up for this when we open an account so that it says somewhere, yes, and we may open more accounts without notifying you?
Yeah, I don't believe that is in the fine print, but there are a lot of things that could be in the fine print that you're not aware of. I think one thing that may have come up yesterday during those hearings was the issue of arbitration. A lot of the big banks and the credit card companies include these clauses in the fine print that say you cannot bring a class action lawsuit against us if something goes wrong. You have to go through private arbitration with appointed people. So basically you're giving up your day in court. You know, you could try to bring a suit on your own, but for most people, especially when it's about a $100 fee or something like that, it's just not worth it. So the CFPB is looking into that. They're looking into eliminating these arbitration clauses so that people can bring a class action suit, because it's just difficult for an individual person to do this. But when many people can come together, that can also get the attention of these regulators who seem to have missed this for years.
My buddy Rudy Maxa is on the line. Hey, Rudy. Hi.
Hi, Carrie. I was just last week, I have a business account at Wells Fargo, and last week I was in Santa Monica, needed to wire some money somewhere, went into a Wells Fargo bank. And when we were all done, the guy said, you got a Wells Fargo credit card? I said, well, no, not really. And he upsold me on it. Now, I will say, I agreed to it. I just got it in the mail yesterday, and there's all these disclosures about what they do with my personal information, and I can opt out of this and opt out of that. And it's fine. So I have obviously I was not one of the fake accounts, but I guess upselling is just going to continue, and I guess I can't blame banks for trying to increase their business with their existing customers, but I just, in retrospect, I want to call the banker and go, hey, you just upsold.
Yeah, but again, that was a face-to-face interaction where you could have said, no, don't want it, don't need it.
And I almost did, but it was an attractive details on the card, so I went ahead and took it. So, I'll buy you lunch someday.
All right, good.
For 15 months on this card.
I'll take you up on that, my friend. All right, thanks for
the
call. So, Lisa, is there any kind of I'm trying to think of when you get your bank statement, not a credit statement, but a bank statement, is there anywhere to look on that statement where you would see maybe an extra fee? You know, any way to do your own checking here?
Sure, yeah. You can look at your statements, look for any fees. You can log on to your account online, see what's there. You know, anytime they're charging you fees, they should be disclosing that somewhere. At least look at your customer agreement and see what's in there. Of course, again, just because these phantom accounts have showed up, look for those too.
We'll get a look at the latest news. We'll continue our conversation here, trying to get a sense of what was going on inside Wells Fargo. The CEO testified on Capitol Hill yesterday. How common this is across the board with other large banks. What to watch out for as an alert bank customer or someone who, you know, you give a glance to your statement. How do you know if some of this might be going on through the bank? Maybe you're spotting unusual fees. Maybe it's time to read some of that fine print. Asking our guests about this. And then I'm interested in your overall level of trust for the bank that you do business with. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter, at Carrie MPR. And to Phil Picardi now with the latest news. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. The chief executive of the Mylan Pharmaceutical Company is on the hot seat on Capitol Hill today. She's trying to explain to lawmakers why the price of the EpiPen has jumped more than 500% since 2007. Lawmakers say families struggling to pay for the emergency allergy shots have every right to be outraged by Mylan, which now charges more than $600 for an EpiPen two-pack. The streets of Charlotte, North Carolina are quiet this morning after violent protests last night. Protests over a fatal police shooting left more than a dozen police officers injured and shut down an interstate. Television footage shows some protesters apparently looting semi-trucks and setting their contents on fire. The protests broke out after a 43-year-old black man was fatally shot by a black police officer at an apartment complex on the city's northeast side. Police say the man refused to drop a weapon. An airstrike on a medical facility in northern Syria has left at least four staff members dead. A Paris-based medical relief organization that runs the facility says last night's attack leveled its medical triage point in rebel-held territory outside the contested city of Aleppo. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights Monitoring Group says nine militants were also killed in that attack. The attack follows Monday night's airstrike on a Syrian Arab Red Crescent aid convoy that killed 20 civilians. And stocks are opening higher on Wall Street, led by gains in energy and materials companies. Crude oil prices rose 2%, sending energy stocks higher. Later today, the Federal Reserve will release its latest decision on interest rates. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:36.
Every Wednesday on All Things Considered, get a taste of regional food and drink trends, reviews, recipes, and advice. Our stable of food experts serve it up on Appetites, plus all the day's top news stories on Minnesota Public Radio News, starting at 3.
On the podcast right now, poet Elizabeth Alexander from Talking Volumes last week on grief and love and loss and truth. If you couldn't be in the audience, you should listen to this conversation. She was terrific. And then voting from yesterday, and does high turnout matter? If you weren't able to catch the show or participate in the show, it's right there waiting for you on the podcast. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes.
Programming is supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, powering what's possible.
Continuing our conversation now, Lisa Gerstner continues with us from Kiplinger's, and Ben Protas is joining us. He's a reporter for the New York Times Deal Book. Ben, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much.
Can I ask you about the culture? Because this is something that I think Senator Warren discussed with the CEO yesterday. What does this incident with Wells Fargo and the fact that they've also paid out a lot of money in fines, I know as many banks have, does it tell you anything about the leadership and the culture inside this bank?
I think that's what they're trying to get to the bottom of. Is this a more systemic issue? Was this a culture issue? Or was it more kind of, you know, just the incentive structure that kind of, you know, incentivized these employees to kind of drum up these sham accounts, and because they basically had the bonuses and their salaries kind of depended on it? So that's the question. Is it just a flawed compensation structure that still should have accountability, you know, higher up the chain? Or was it part of this broader systemic problem?
And from your reporting, do you have a sense of this might be, you know, a number of CEOs at other big banks are looking within their own practices today after this?
Absolutely. You know, we've talked to sources who said that they, at other big banks, that they ordered kind of SWAT teams, as they call them, you know, to kind of unearth whether or not there were other similar problems at banks like JP Morgan and the like. And, you know, so far the conclusion has been no. And some of these executives have said so at conferences and publicly. But, you know, I think that they're always reluctant to totally issue a blanket statement. Yes, we're in the clear. I think in particular, Wells had this incentive. System, this compensation structure that perhaps made it particularly a problem here.
I see.
Any one bad actor could appear at any bank, but this was a broader problem there.
You know, Lisa, quick question to you about this incentive structure. Is that anything that you could, as a customer, ever ask about, and would the bank disclose that?
You can certainly ask. It doesn't hurt to try. You know, asking questions anytime you're in there is good. And you know, one of the people in the conference I listened in on yesterday pointed that out, that you know, sometimes the bankers would be encouraged to just sign people up for things without asking them. They say, oh, we're going to get you a debit card, or we're going to put you in online banking. And you can say, why are you doing that? Do you have to do that? Is this a necessary part of my account? So certainly do your homework there.
Okay. To Joe in Minneapolis. Hi, Joe. Good morning.
Hi, Carrie. It's Jill. I'm on the road, so I'm sorry if there's background noise. But
okay.
I just wanted to share, I'm a current client of Wells Fargo, have been for many years, but what made me more interested is I'm a former investment management professional and had many dealings with this executive management team over the years, 20-plus years in the business. And I want to say that the culture, the aggressive culture at Wells Fargo existed prior to the CEO. It really was rooted in the Norwest culture that the company was based here in Minneapolis when Dick Kovacevich was running the company prior to the acquisition of Wells Fargo when they moved to San Francisco. But he would always talk about their aggressive cross-sell tactics and trying to grab greater share of wallet. And it really is all about boosting the bank's bottom line. It's not only fee income, but interest income. It's the avenues that these financial institutions earn their money.
Jill,
that bottom line grows.
Jill, I have to interrupt here. Forgive me. Your phone is fading in it. I think I got the essence of what you were going to say, that the culture of this existed before Wells Fargo came in and bought out Norwest, which was based here in Minnesota. A call here from Scott in the Twin Cities. Hi, Scott. What's your experience with this?
Hi. I was a personal banker at Wells Fargo in the Twin Cities here about 11 years ago, and I'm not surprised that this has finally become public. They had extremely high sales goals, and the offices were only maybe two or three people out of the 9 or 10 bankers would meet the sales goal. If they didn't, they were basically let go after a quarter. If you did make it, you basically just made a couple of $100 each quarter. It wasn't a huge amount of money. As far as, it kind of sounds like there's a misperception, too, that a lot of these fees went directly to the bankers, but that's not true. They just went to the bank. A lot of the sales goals were not just selling a free checking account, but selling packages where you had checking accounts that had minimum balances, that also had a savings account, online banking, an ATM card, a credit card, lines of credit, et cetera.
Wow.
Which is fine if that's what the clients wanted, but a lot of times they were just told they were going to get a package and people would be signed up for personal lines of credit, credit cards. And every time you apply for credit, those things count against your credit score. And those things were not disclosed to customers. I recall many mornings working and having somebody come in angry that they had been sent a credit product and they had never signed up for it. So they'd call us over to talk to them. We take it to our manager. And it basically just got brushed under the rug because our goals were theirs goals, which were the district manager's goals, and it just went up the chain
way. So, Scott, you're raising something that I wanted to ask Ben about. Ben, how reasonable is it that some pretty high-level executives would not be aware of the tactics that were used to incentivize employees to sell these products?
I think it's unlikely that they didn't know about the tactics and the sales.
Unlikely they didn't know. Okay.
Right. I think they probably did know about the tactics and the goals. The question is, did they know that employees at the branch level were pushing back and saying, hey, we can't do this. I mean, they held, my colleague Michael Corkery reported last week that they held actually training sessions for employees saying, do not sell sham accounts. They knew this was an issue. Whether or not they knew it before 2011, 2012, when this kind of conduct, was really beginning, is a little unclear. And they're still actually trying to get to the bottom of when exactly it did start. But I think the question is, it's not just enough to know when you think about, regulatory charges, civil charges, criminal charges even. It's not just enough to know that there was an incentivized structure. It's also you have to get to the bottom of, did they know that they were actually creating sham accounts? And that's really just too soon to tell. We have to see what the investigators turn up.
And once we see what the investigators turn up, I think there's some cynicism. I'm seeing a lot of it on Twitter that, somebody highest up the chain is not going to have to be held accountable for that. I mean, this is something Senator Warren was talking about yesterday.
It's a reasonable question. I think that if you've looked around to the other banks, take J.P. Morgan, for example. J.P. Morgan has paid, $13 billion to settle mortgage-related problems and billions of dollars for other issues, and Jamie Dimon remains their CEO.
Right.
Now, I think that at the end of the day, that's because the shareholders of that company believe Jamie is absolutely the best person to lead that company. And so I think these banks are not, despite what happened in 2008, they are not public trust they operate, you know, for, and exist for their shareholders. And so it's really a decision by the board and shareholders kind of what to do with both clawing back compensation and then, of course, what to do with the CEO. I think, you know, it remains to be seen whether or not the executive management team at Wells will kind of survive this. I think there are moments there where we thought Jamie wouldn't survive his various regulatory problems, and sure enough, he did. So I think if that's any indication, I think John Stumpf might be in for the long haul.
So, Lisa, one last question for you. A listener here says, I've switched to a credit union for my personal banking. I hate big banks. We hear a lot from people who are like, you won't have these problems if you bank with a credit union. Is that mostly true?
Well, I think credit unions definitely have that reputation that they tend to be more local, you know, very, very focused on the customer. And, yeah, a lot of people, I think, are happier with credit unions. Now, that's not to say that you'll be unhappy with a big bank. It just depends on what you want. Some people really like the convenience of a big bank, you know, the ATMs all over the country, having branches everywhere. It boils down to what you need. But, you know, credit unions are generally a pretty good deal.
I appreciate the time this morning, Lisa. Thanks much.
All right. Thank you.
And Ben, a question here from Twitter from a listener who says, when the banks get fined, do the customers effectively pay those fines through the account fees that they've been charged?
It's a great question. Shareholders pay the fine. So if I own stock in Wells Fargo, I'm going to be essentially paying for that because, you know, the banks are paying for this, you know, out of their own, you know, accounts. This is not necessarily that the fee just gets not, you know, that the, you know, the banking customer just all of a sudden pays the fee. It's more like the shareholders pay the fee. Now, in this particular instance, also, the CFPB, the regulatory agency, did force Wells Fargo to refund, you know, unnecessary and illegal fees here. So in some cases, they've tried to be proactive about this too. So hopefully, at the end of the day, you know, if you're a customer who got ripped off by Wells Fargo, you're going to get your money back. That's the goal of the regulators at this point. And then the fines will be paid by the shareholders.
And then Paul says on Twitter, Congress may not be able to claw back the bonuses, but we can dump Wells Fargo stock, close accounts, drive the stock price down. Well, that is one way for people who are really concerned about this to have their voice heard, isn't it?
It certainly is. I think, and not to say that, you know, one person can't make a difference, but I would, you know, it's the largest bank by market cap in the country. It's the largest mortgage lender. This is a big banking behemoth. And I think that, you know, yes, the stock is heading down. It was down about 7% as of about a day or so ago. So certainly there's some indication that, you know, people are pushing back and are concerned more likely just about the future of the bank, how many additional fines might come.
Right.
You know, what's the future here for the executive management team, you know, so I think that is a real thing. But let's not lose sight that a few people dumping their stock and a few people closing their accounts isn't going to radically change the structure of one of the largest banks in the country.
Yeah, I would say I hear you on that. It may not change the practice of Wells Fargo, but it might be the thing that you can do to say, I don't approve of this and I'm not going to do business with an organization
right.
that behaves this way.
Absolutely, and I think that that's how people send the message. I think that there was a question earlier about credit unions. I think when there are, and there have been some issues with credit unions, I think it's a little easier to kind of have your message resonate when it's a smaller institution, a community bank, a credit union, rather than, you know, a big, huge banking, you know, company like Wells Fargo. On the other hand, you know, enough people kind of deliver the message, and they have thrived on this account growth, and they've thrived on mortgage growth in particular. With refinancings. And so I think that if the business slows, that really does send a message to management.
Okay, good to know. To Bill in Minneapolis. Hi, Bill. You were in banking for a while. Is that right?
That's right. And I'd just like to make a couple points. Number one, you know, the cross-selling is something that occurs really throughout the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there's a profit motive behind it, but really the primary motive is that the more accounts, the more relationships that customers have with the bank, the more likely they are to stay put. And so it's kind of a customer preservation focus.
Okay, so you're saying it's really not about the fees. It's about securing that customer's business for the long term?
Exactly. That's the primary motivation. Now, obviously, you know, every service, every product that the bank sells does have a profit potential to it, but it's really keeping customers. That is the primary motive.
I see.
And I guess secondly, I would just point out that, you know, there's a lot of bank bashing here, and some of it certainly justified, but this is really a administration issue where the bank has not properly supervised people. And certainly it's in an environment that really prompted this kind of behavior, you know, a high-pressure sales environment. It's hard to defend that. But this is really a situation where the bank management just hasn't supervised, you know, the practices and procedures of employees in a proper way.
Let me bring Ben in to that. Ben, is that what you'd call an administrative problem here, where the supervision was not robust enough?
I think you could have a semantic debate about what exactly at the root of this administrative, you know, or management. But I think the caller was right on a couple of fronts. One is that I think a failure to supervise is absolutely, you know, kind of one component of this. The question is whether or not it goes beyond just a failure to supervise, and whether or not the higher up levels of management knew that this was happening and turned a blind eye. So it's
right.
One thing to kind of not take an active role in overseeing your employees, which is a problem, and that's more on the administrative end. But I think legitimately, people like Senator Warren and others are questioning whether or not it actually, you know, was more turning a blind eye to it. The other thing he said about the cross-selling is absolutely true. I think that the calculation is, in fact, in some cases, by the way, the bankers closed the accounts. You know, it really was just about generating an account and
right.
not necessarily really profiting from all the fees. So I think, you know, cross-selling is huge across the industry, but particularly at Wells Fargo, they've really emphasized the cross-selling and having multiple accounts. And basically what they figured out is that it's a lot easier to keep a customer than how to go out and find a new one.
Hmm.
And so if you can keep one and sign him or her up for five or six different accounts, that's just as good as having to find five or six new customers, and it's a lot easier because you're just keeping them and you have the customer retention. The problem there is when you kind of start creating accounts that aren't, you know, it all comes down to disclosure. If you're not disclosing it to the employee, then you're talking about fraudulent accounts.
Let me go back to, hey, Bill, are you still there?
Yes.
To what Ben just said about the real question here is, yes, they might not have been managing this very well, but how high up in the organization does it go where they were aware that this was happening? Don't you have a question about that?
Yes. Oh, sure. Absolutely. And I think that's a tough question to answer. But it would seem to me, and I think Bennett commented on this earlier, it's hard to believe that you know, the executives that oversaw the branch banking stuff here, that they didn't know that this was a real problem, and it's obvious they didn't attack it as aggressively as they should have.
Yeah. Ben, Bill, I appreciate the call. Ben, I wanted to ask you about, it's been noted and reported here that Carrie Tolstead, who mm-hmm. headed the unit that was doing some of this, is retiring with a golden parachute, $125 million in stock options and some other incentives. Can Congress do anything about that or not?
Congress can yell about it.
But they're pretty good at that.
Yeah, look, at the end of the day, this is a board decision. That's what the CEO said yesterday, you know, in testifying. And he's, you know, certainly he could influence the decision. But I think at the end of the day, this is up to the board about whether or not there's a compensation committee on the board. This is set up precisely to deal with issues like this. Do you need to claw back compensation? Now, the board is going to take its cue from shareholders, especially the large ones, and from customers. And so I think that they're going to hear the outcry. I would be surprised if there were not a clawback issue here.
Yeah.
But there's really not much that Congress, you know, can do other than kind of wag its finger.
Yeah. Question for you here from Peter in St. Paul. Hi, good morning, Peter, and thanks so much for waiting.
Good morning.
What do you want to say or ask?
Oh, yeah, I just a little context. First of all, and this is related to the question, Norwest purchased Wells Fargo. So most of the leadership in Wells Fargo
thanks for the clarification on that.
Minnesota-based, not they
Got
just
it.
Moved the heads to San Francisco. Most of it's still run in Minneapolis.
Thank you.
But with that, John Stumpf is from my hometown, much older than I am, obviously, mm-hmm. Piers, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Grew up on a very poor dairy farm, paid his way through St. Cloud State. I'm just curious, first of all, the reporters you had, were they aware of that? And second, you basically have someone who grew up working class as a CEO of a top 20 corporation in the U.S. I don't think there's too many of them. Does it matter? Maybe this case suggests it doesn't matter. And is that something that they think about when they're covering these issues?
That's a really good question. Ben, what would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. We did actually know that, and it was one of our stories that, correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, we had in our story that Piers is about a population of about 1,400. So, you know,
that right, Peter? Peter, are you there? Oh, we might have lost him.
Might have lost him. Okay. Yeah. Well, my understanding, that's what we've said before. And so certainly it's a fascinating story, and he's kind of really pulled himself, you know, kind of from modest means. And, you know, he paid himself through St. Cloud State. And, you know, kind of in the 70s, he was a repo agent. You know, he was basically a debt collector for a small bank in Minnesota, and kind of worked his way up, you know, through that chain. Certainly that is something that we kind of, in trying to build a body of, you know, kind of research about who somebody is and who their character is and kind of where they come from. It's really important. It's important for readers to know. He's not the only one. I would say Lloyd Blankfein, you know, came from a middle-class family in the Bronx, you know, in fact, lived in the housing projects in the Bronx. Certainly there are others, Angelo Mozilo, who was the head of Countrywide, which ultimately blew up in the crisis. His father was a butcher also in the Bronx. So it's not unheard of that these folks come from modest means and kind of really build a huge career. You know, it certainly does not exempt them from kind of having to behave ethically. And I think that that's kind of, you know, although it's fascinating, their personal narrative and their story, you know, we have to put it in the context of the news we're learning here about what happened at his bank.
Ben, let me ask you about another banking issue that comes out of Minnesota or has a strong Minnesota tie. The Minneapolis Federal Reserve President Neel Kashkari has said that he said this in February, that there are still too many banks that are so large that they couldn't fail because they would endanger the American economy. He took quite a bit of heat for that. And again, I will say he said this, you know, a few months ago. But what's your sense of whether that's true and whether there is any concern about that on Wall Street or among the banks themselves?
Well, he certainly took a lot of heat from the banking establishment. I think he kind of became a bit of a folk hero in the kind of populace, both on the right and the left. And he's an interesting character because he did work for the Bush administration that was involved in the bailouts in 2008. So he's kind of has a unique vision into kind of what is too big to fail. He certainly has an appreciation for that. I think that, you know, look, at the end of the day, a lot has changed since 2008. Dodd-Frank kind of, you know, changed radically the day-to-day of these institutions. Things like the Volcker Rule have kind of eliminated some risky activity. The banking regulators have imposed very high capital standards and requirements on the banks. And so that's in the event of a disaster, they're going to have more set aside and earmarked for kind of covering, you know, real problematic issues. Are these banks still huge? Absolutely. Are these banks potentially still going to need some form of government intervention if there's, you know, terrible event that spreads systemically throughout the economy? You know, I think that that's a reasonable, you know, viewpoint. Most hold that. I would say that the view, though, you asked what the view on Wall Street is. I think the view is becoming increasingly not just with the banks, but investors and regulators. Forget about too big to fail. Is it too big to manage? And so.
Huh.
I think that, you know, at the end of the day, these banks are not going anywhere. They're not going to go out of business. And, you know, I think we're better protected than we were in 2008. But we're going to continue to see scandals like this one in Wells Fargo. We saw a bunch of scandals at J.P. Morgan, the London Whale. We saw all the mortgage issues there and other banks, too. It's not unique to any one bank. And what we hear every time is that, hey, we have hundreds of thousands of employees. We can't help it if a couple dozen, even a couple thousand are behaving badly, and these are rogue actors. And so the question becomes, let's say they're right. Is this a case of too big to manage, where even if people at the very top have good intentions, they just cannot catch every last problem and pocket across their sprawling international institution?
Ben, really good to have you. I hope you'll come back sometime when we can chat again. Thank you very much. Ben Protest with us. He's a reporter for the New York Times Deal Book column. This is NPR News with Carrie Miller.